Welcome to Author Stories, the podcast where we talk to the best writers in the industry and discuss writing and the creative process. Whether you are a writer, a reader, or both, we hope you'll find something here that makes you love books and the writers that create them. You can find archives of all of the great conversations I've had with authors over the years at hankgarner.com. Take some time and browse around there. I'm sure you'll find a new author to love, find inspiration for your own creative life, and find a new story to get lost in. My guest today is playwright and novelist Frank Strasser, who joins me to talk about his new book, Plastic, which is a creepy look at the inside of fame and fortune. Before we talk to Frank, let's thank some sponsors who make the show possible. Jasper T. Scott. His box set, Dark Space, the complete series. This is 6 books bundled together, on sale now for 99 cents. 6 complete books, over 600,000 copies sold, more than 2,000 pages of epic space opera for the low price of 99 cents. Also available in Kindle Unlimited if you're a Kindle Unlimited subscriber. Humanity is defeated. 10 years ago, the Scythians invaded the galaxy with one goal: to wipe out the human race. Now the survivors are hiding in the last human sector of the galaxy, Dark Space, once a place of exile for criminals, now the last refuge of mankind. The once galaxy-spanning Imperium of Star Systems is left guarding the gate, which is the only way in or out of Dark Space, but not everyone is satisfied with their governance. Freelancer and ex-convict Ethan Ortain is on the run. He owes crime lord Alec Barandi 10,000 souls, and his ship is badly damaged. When Barandi catches up with him, he makes an offer Ethan can't refuse. Ethan must infiltrate and sabotage the Valiant, the Imperial Star System's fleet carrier which stands guarding the entrance of Dark Space, and then his debt will be cleared. While Ethan is still undecided about what he'll do, he realizes that the Imperium has been lying and putting all of Dark Space at risk. Now Brondi's plan is starting to look like a necessary evil, but before Ethan can act on it, he discovers that the real plan was much more sinister than what he was told, and he will be lucky to escape the Valiant alive. Grab all 6 books for 99 cents right now. Dark Space, the complete series by Jasper T. Scott. The Unwelcome Trilogy by R.D. Brady. Survivor, Mother, Leader, and Humanity's Last Chance. Deep within the remnants of the United States, Lila Richards oversees a camp of 200 survivors. In a world where living is an everyday struggle, and only through banding together can people survive, the arrival of the unwelcome only made her job harder. Riley Quinn and Miles Jones have been raised by Lila for the last 5 years. They're also one of the cursed, the children between the ages of 13 and 18, whom the unwelcome kill on sight. No questions, no pleas, just death. Protecting one another and the people of their camp is ingrained in all of them. But now each of them faces increased danger as the reason why the cursed have been targeted by the unwelcome slowly comes to light. And that truth will shock them to their core. Now time is running out, not just for the cursed who are being hunted down by the unwelcome, not just for Lila and her family who will face the greatest challenge yet, but for all of humanity. The world changed radically 35 years ago, but today humanity's very existence is on the line, and the fight has begun that will ensure its future or its annihilation. Fans of A.G. Riddle, James Rollins, Suzanne Collins, and Brandon Sanderson will love the Unwelcome Trilogy. Pick up your copy of the Unwelcome Trilogy on Amazon today. Edge of Valor, a military sci-fi thriller by Josh Hayes. When their mission fails, his begins. David Weber calls it a tour de force. Special Agent Jackson Fisher is a man after truth. When a military operation to extract a high-ranking ambassador from the war-torn border world of Stonemaier ends in disaster, Fisher is called in to investigate. A whole platoon went in, but only 3 Alliance Marines returned home, the rest killed in action along with hundreds of civilians. With tensions between the Holloman Alliance and Stonemaier rising, Fisher attempts to stitch the pieces together. One thing becomes more and more certain: the surviving Marines are lying. As the truth unfurls, Fisher begins to realize this was far more than a simple rescue mission, and that the truth might be something best left buried. filled with action, mystery, and well-crafted characters, Edge of Valor, the Valor series book one, will put you into a world of war, conspiracy, and betrayal. It's perfect for fans of David Weber's Honorverse or Tom Clancy's Jack Ryan with a futuristic flair. That's Edge of Valor by Josh Hayes. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Frank Strasser on the show with me today. He is a playwright and a novelist, and he has a brand new book out called Plastic. And this book is phenomenal, guys. It's wry, a little scary, a little edge of your seat. There's something there for everybody. Welcome to the show, Frank.
Hey, pleasure to meet you.
I'm glad to have you, Frank. We begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Well, you know, it goes back, I think I was about 7 or 8 years old, and I started a little club. I was always starting clubs to write scary stories. I think, you know, it was the once upon a time beginning. but hey, you know, it's amazing. I think I've always wanted to be a writer and always thought of myself as a writer. I mean, some of us, they say that writers have to write. Maybe there really is something to that. And maybe at a very early age, it was just part of me.
Well, it sounds like you've always been a fan of scary stories or, you know, unsettling stories. Do you remember a time when you were introduced to a story like that, maybe a story or an author that kind of lit your imagination in that area?
Well, you know, actually a lot of my work is, and particularly with the theater, has been comedic, but I do like things that are a little edgy. I like to be provoked, and provocation is probably a big thing. And I suspect some of it goes back to maybe in my earlier days, really liking punk rock and just really liking shock and just things that unsettled. And I think that I was gravitated a little bit to the my gravitation to the theater probably comes from the idea that is a place that's supposed to be unsafe. It's supposed to be dangerous. It isn't really often the case these days because everything else is unsafe and dangerous. We turn on the TV. but that concept, that idea is wonderful. And when you mention that, when I was in college, I went to UC Santa Barbara. I had my roommate was a set designer, and he had worked on Jean Genet's The Maids that was doing a production at school, and I went to see that, and wow, that was a real revelation. You know, these two women that were working at killing the madame, and then ended up play acting the whole thing amongst themselves. It was such a edgy and mind-bending experience. It showed me what's possible,
Before that introduction to the Maids in college, what were you pursuing at the time?
Well, I was an English major, and I had been a prolific reader, a lot of foreign literature. I was very much into Russian literature, things like that. I kind of considered myself as somebody who was going to be a writer in some form or another. I was really engaging with fiction, and I really wanted to be a novelist, frankly. I had no ideas about theater. That came later.
In that early desire to be a novelist, had you gotten any encouragement from anyone along the way that maybe saw something in you and encouraged that gift?
Well, my parents always taught me to believe in whatever I wanted to do. And my mom was quite creative. In fact, she was a sculptress, and she had started several companies that were involved with design. But I didn't really have anyone around me that was per se pushing me in that direction. It just came from me. And I always believed that whatever I wanted to do, I could do. And that of course, is a wonderful thing for a young person. It doesn't necessarily make it so.
Right. There's still a lot of hard work that goes in between.
Exactly, yeah. Nothing's given to you.
That's right.
And I've learned that certainly in this craft. This is a very tough thing to have success in this field. This is one of the harder ones, certainly.
So what led you to start writing for theater?
Well, I've been working on a novel for like 12 years.
And, I think a lot of people can relate to
really,
that.
It's really tough. And I've learned that a literary agent that I had spoken with had suggested that I take Robert McKee's story structure class, a seminar. And I signed up for that. And one of the things he advised, and he was very helpful. I mean, it was very wonderful breakthrough experience, his book story and whatever. But he said that writers should consider taking an acting class. And it was, truthfully, where I was at that point in my life, I mean, my idea of an acting class would be I'd go to three of these, I'd meet a bunch of actresses, check off the box that I'd done an acting class. That was my idea of what it would be involved. And it took me about 8 months or so. I was actually waiting online a yoga class and this actress friend of mine, Deborah Wakeham, who had considerable success and read a little bit of what I was working on. I was standing there and she was right in front of me, and it suddenly occurred to me. I said, "Deborah, I'm looking to take an acting class." And she said, "Oh my God, well, you should study with Milton. You should go to the Beverly Hills Playhouse." And she had been there previously for 12 years. And so I went and met with them, and I had to give a writing sample. And they said, "Well, Milton would be willing to take me on as the only writer in a 100-person master class," really, that's what it was. It was this master class. As a scene study class on Saturdays. But she said, "You have to decide to do this for at least a year. Otherwise, it wouldn't really be worth it." And I ended up being there for 2.5 years. And it was an amazing experience. And it changed my life in innumerable ways. I remember that first morning, that first Saturday, there would be three scenes, each about a half an hour. And Milton, in the dark there in his director's chair, would be taking notes. And then after each scene, he would really destroy he would rip apart the whole thing and for over an hour. And the actors would often be crying at the edge of the stage. And I remember that first scene from Frankie and Johnny that I saw. These actors sometimes worked on it for months. And, there was a woman running around naked on the stage, and I thought to myself, "Wow, well, I could do this for a year. This is great." And but I ended up workshopping my first play, Powder Room, there, I just learned so much. It was a revolution for me. It was so unlike what I had experienced, and I had taken a lot of writing classes, little workshops and things. It's so page bound. And what getting the work up on its feet, breaking it apart in that other dimension was profound.
You can, in reading Plastic, your new book, which is out everywhere now, for the listeners, you can tell that you really honed your craft in playwriting, because the dialogue is just razor sharp. Is that something when you're working on the craft of playwriting? What is that process like of learning to get dialogue just right? Because I mean, that's the essence of playwriting, is dialogue. You know, there's a minimal amount of stage direction there, but you know, the director then, you know, interprets all that. But the dialogue has to be perfect to really resonate. And can you talk a little bit about what that process is like of learning to write dialogue, and then maybe in transitioning that to novel writing?
Sure. Well, you know, I think I've always been reasonably good with dialogue, but what you have to do is you have to inhabit each of your characters. You really have to know your characters, and you have to know what they're going to say, and almost be so quick with knowing what they're going to say that you can cut off the other character. And part of that is being in the moment, and you have to really, I mean, that is an acting phrase, being in the moment, but it means that you're inhabiting that moment fully in the shoes of each character. So one character is saying something, you know, the other character has to react. They cannot be passive. And so there's an energy in that, and you have to, as you learn your characters and just be free with it and allow yourself to just explore what they would say in those moments. And I think a lot of my dialogue, one of the things that I would say in my work, I learned this a lot from studying with Milton, was that conflict is central to your work, to a successful work. And you have to have conflict. And those scenes where people are just meandering in the conversation, there's nothing going on. If there's stuff going on, the dialogue will be animated and alive. If nobody has any motivation, and that goes back to actors too. What is their motivation? What is your character's motivation? If all the characters have a motivation, and there's conflict, the scene will be very alive, and the dialogue will be snappy. And that I think is key.
That's is there such a thing as too much conflict in dialogue? And is there a fine line between conflict and just belligerence?
Well, you know, the thing is that there are moments in our lives, and we've all been there, where we can't take it anymore, and we either strike somebody or do something, or we leave. You know, so it isn't all about verbal, it's also physical, and how we receive what's being presented to us and how we handle it. And so I don't think that there's anything that's too extreme. In fact, I would prefer to think that I could take things to the ultimate extreme, because that's the goal. And the thing is, though, there's also reality. There are constraints. There are constraints on people. Certainly the people in my book, for example, Plastic Surgeon, he's a gentleman. And he's put into a situation that starts to tear at that. You know, you can't always behave in the civilized manner, which we believe and hope that we will. you have to respond to what's being presented. So it's a fine line, because you know the reader knows, or the audience knows, you know, what's real and what feels real. I do think that there's such a thing as a what we call in the theater heightened reality. And that's what you attempt for in fiction, and you want things to be larger than life, not just true to life. And that was frankly the note that I received, and kind of brings a full circle on that first novel that I was working on, was that it was too true to life and not bigger than life. And I ended up really receiving that note and wrestling with it, and you want heightened reality, you want drama.
You mentioned a minute ago that you spent 12 years working on a novel and found yourself writing plays. What brought you back around to novel writing again?
Well, the same time I was at the Playhouse, I'm workshopping my first play, The Powder Room, I started to, and as I do, I'm a big student of what's around me. I found myself, I was at that point in my life, I was in publishing. I was had a magazine company, and I was not really a person who had been part of Hollywood. And here I was in this class with people like Ann Archer and Giovanni Ribisi and Jenna Elfman and Robert Blake, the accused murderer, you know, who were a very interesting group of people there. And they were ostensibly the beautiful people, you know, as we know them. I mean, they were glamorous. They were stars, some of them. And I was there, and I was realizing how tenuous all that is and how insecure many of them were. And I started to think about working on what I would describe as my L.A. novel, my great L.A. novel, which was Plastic. And what happened was I started to think about this place, which I called the Capital of Good Looks. And I thought, who would be at the center of this? And I decided it would be a plastic surgeon. And I thought of calling it Plastic. And then that central event, which is the disfigurement of the pop star Faye Ray, was right at the core of it, this man that gets called in. And again, wrestling with the issues that I found around me, which was this judgment and insecurity and vulnerability that comes with aging out, as it were. I mean, there were people in my class that were 35, 36, 37 years old that were already, their career was winding down. And they knew it, you know, the managers, the agents were leaving. And maybe they were actually getting to be at the top of the craft. But age is a it doesn't take prisoners, you know. It's just brutal, you know. They were up against that, and that's why many of the people were in that class. Frankly, was I felt that they were there because things had started to happen in their career, and they felt they needed to go to a master acting coach. To figure out both professionally, but also their work, what was going on. Many of them had a chip on their shoulder. Anyway, it was fascinating to me, and it introduced me to a new world, and that's the world that I explore in Plastic.
Well, the book reads like a great California mystery, like a Raymond Chandler novel. Were you intentionally channeling that, if not Chandler himself, that motif, that feel in the book?
Well, I wanted to write great LA novel. I've been a student of many of those stories, And certainly I watch a lot of TCM, all the old noirish films. It has a noir quality to it. I'd say like a little, there's an element of like, I think of noir and color, like Chinatown, you know. I wanted something that was very modern, but also harkens a little bit back to those older stories. I mean, we're all inspired by what came before.
Of course. Well, it's also been compared to some modern TV shows like Nip Tuck and Ray Donovan, which let us, you know, those of us that don't live in that world, to kind of peel back the covers a little bit and see Hollywood excess and the, you know, the lives of the beautiful people and how a lot of times there's a lot of facade and not a lot under there. Tell me about the character of Fay Wray and how she came to you.
Well, I had a friend in that period. And, you know, this is, I actually conceived and started, the first draft of Plastic was written in 2001. It's been a long time and coming to get it published and whatever, and it continued to evolve. But back in that period, I had a very good friend, Matt Sharam, who is a pop star in Australia. She had more ARIA awards, which are like Grammys, than anyone, and for her big hit album. And she had come to America to make it. And she was the inspiration for Fay Wray. I found her to be it was a bit of a mess, the whole thing. I mean, she's a genius, but she also was very much wanting to do things her own way. And the machinery of the industry and the whole thing was, it wasn't really working. You know, she was sort of being ground up. And so she was a key inspiration for Fay Wray. And obviously the name Fay Wray, you think of the siren, the actress that played, who is Fay Wray, who played the part in the first King Kong. And that is all about man versus nature. The other inspiration, if you will, it came a little later, but certainly provoked me to think a lot, was Lana Clarkson, who had been in my play, The Powder Room, and who is a friend, and who was murdered by Phil Spector. And senselessly, I'd say. And that senseless celebrity on celebrity or celebrity against a small person crime, that was very, that provoked me to think a lot about the nature of what happened to Fay and the nature of how these bigger celebrities and power in Hollywood sort of snuffs out some of these smaller, you know, people. And and that's very much explored in the book.
The idea of perfection is right there in the book, and the links people will go to for perfection, but then the links people will go to attack others and to ruin someone's idea of perfection. The world of you know, music and glamour and all of that kind of intersect in this. Did your love of punk rock earlier in your life did that surface in the writing of this?
It does go to my interest in pushing things to an extreme. I do think that Fay is just this raw talent that's being packaged as Max. They attempted to package Max, and you can't, these feral creatures. I mean, the character Fay Wray, her name originally was Susan Plouse. She came from Iowa at 15 and ran away and came to LA to make it. And at 19, she's, become a pop star. And that's a force of nature, somebody like that. I really found her a fascinating character. And, you know, you become so, you know, these are all people that are part of my life. You know, I've lived with them a long time. They're like family to me. But it is a fascinating person. And it's so, you know, to think that she would find herself in this situation and to have her handlers, her people there trying to suppress what had happened. And I mean, the essence of the story is that Harry Previn, the celebrated plastic surgeon, is called in after she's being violently disfigured. And he thinks he's there to restore her looks, but begins to realize that he's there to surgically erase evidence of the crime. So he becomes part of a conspiracy. And so, you know, you think you trust in people around you, and who is in a situation where you have to be more trusting than a person who's been injured? And you find that everybody is actually has other ideas as to what their goals are. You know, it's not necessarily your well-being. And it's a very interesting subject.
Plastic is, like I said earlier, an edge of your seat thrill ride. I actually got the book yesterday afternoon, and I read, you know, better than half the book in one sitting last night. I had to eventually pull myself away and go to bed so that we could record today. But I absolutely love what you're doing, and it is it's spellbinding. You know, it's this look into a world that we all think we know or have opinions about, and the truth can sometimes be worse than you anticipated. Frank, when people finish the book, when they close that back cover, what do you hope they're left with?
Well, as I say, I'm very interested in provoking. I do want people to you know, it's funny how people go to see movies and they start talking about something else the minute they walk out the door. I want people to still be engaging with the material well after they, you know, have it stay with them. And, you know, one of the things is I do want them to wrestle with the idea of we are in a beauty-obsessed world. What price beauty? What does all this mean? And, Faye is a kind of siren call to the world about what our subjective views are, what we're imposing on ourselves, and it's not just the characters in this book, it's everyone. It's a virus that we're encountering, which is this obsession with beauty. It's not altogether, listen, I'm probably as obsessed about beauty as anyone. I love beautiful women around me. I love anybody, you know, a guy doesn't, but there's something unhealthy about it at the same time. And
disconnection from reality.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Well, Frank, the book Plastic is available everywhere. There's links to it in the show notes of this episode. If people are just learning about you and want to connect with you and learn more, is there a place where they can find you online?
Yes. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Facebook. There's frankstrausser.com is my website. You can follow me there. That's Strausser. And also, I might add that the book has just come out on audio. And I had two actors read because it's from two points of view, and it's very dramatic. I'd have nothing less.
Excellent. We're going to send everyone to pick up their copy of Plastic and to look you up online. Frank, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today, and thanks for such an exceptional book.
Thank you very much for everything. That's a very interesting conversation. Cheers, and enjoy the book, everyone.
Thanks to Frank Strasser for joining me on the show today. Now stay tuned for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
I was walking through the woods between Wolfert's Roost and the future site of my father's stone manor house. The house would eventually stand on what had been old Baltus's pumpkin field, the land where I had found my grandfather's head. Father had chosen the spot for its view of the Hudson River. Knoll was to be a grand mansion in the Gothic Revival style, but at the time the mansion was but a few foundations of Van Brunt stone. I had become fond of the place already, the idea of it, and I spent many a night alone in a shack on the property. My mother disapproved. She would have me sleep in the room across from hers in our townhouse. But I was 15 and did not answer to her. I kept a bottle of spirits hidden in the crook of two walnut trees near old Baltus's grave. I thought he would approve of the gesture. I had stopped along my way to fetch it out. At the moment the first pull of liquor touched my throat, I heard a ghastly, inhuman laugh. I was not alone in the woods. Had God sent the horseman after me? Had I sinned that terribly? I ran through the wood and found the field where Knoll was to be built. The outline of the foundations was barely discernible beneath the snow. An apparition stood there. Though I have seen him many times since, I shall never forget my first glimpse. Gaunt in moonlight, headless, exuding power and malice. A magic thing in the land of the ordinary. The headless horseman of Sleepy Hollow. What chills those words evoke. It charged at me, hatchet raised. I stood transfixed, unable to move, unable to even imagine escape. This was the servant of God, after all, sent to strike down sinners. I hurled the bottle from my hand, ashamed that I had become a drunkard as Baltus had been. It shattered against the foundations of Knoll. I stretched out my arms and awaited judgment. A piercing white light broke the darkness. The horse reared.
"Not my Dillon!" cried Agatha,
appearing from the wood. She held a skull in her hand. It shone brightly as a diamond. And in that moment I understood. The horseman did not serve God. He served my grandmother. Perhaps in that moment I came to see Agatha and God as one and the same. The unholy spirit fought her command. A foreleg of the demon horse struck my head with such power that I fell backwards with a cry and knew no more. I carry the scar to this day. A slight indentation in my temple, barely noticeable. In my days of courting, I was told that when I am angry, the patch of insulted skull bone will stand out in a disturbing manner. I have never had occasion to see this phenomenon, however, as I am generally well pleased whenever I pass a mirror.